Today is Tuesday, January the 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington.
And I'm Jason Patinkin. The impeachment trial of U.S. President Donald Trump begins today in the U.S. Senate. The third time in U.S. history a president faces removal from office for allegedly violating his oath.
The other's just a hoax. It's the witch hunt that's been going on for years, and it's frankly, it's disgraceful.
Also ahead, world leaders meeting in Davos at the World Economic Forum. Spotlight asks some of the global challenges, including climate change and poverty. It is all on today's International Edition.
Our top story today, the impeachment trial of U.S. President Donald Trump began Tuesday in the U.S. Senate. Only the third time in U.S. history a president faces removal from office for allegedly violating his oath. Before the trial gets underway, the Senate will start with a vote on Republican leader Mitch McConnell's proposed timeline and other outstanding issues related to the trial. To give us a breakdown on what to expect in the next 24 hours is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Thanks for joining us, Catherine.
You're so welcome.
So first, what's happening today as the trial opens?
Well, today is really the first day that things really get rolling up here on Capitol Hill. Of course, last week we saw some of the ceremonial procedures that start an impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate, swearing those senators in so that they will administer impartial justice. Of course, this week is a little bit more political, and that's what we're going to be seeing is this battle that could last well into the night over the way the impeachment procedure is going to work, whether the Democrats get those witnesses and documents admitted as evidence, as they've been arguing and asking for over these past few months. I would not put it past Mitch McConnell to block all of those. We're going to have a very interesting day here on Capitol Hill.
And so in regards to those rules and procedures for witnesses and evidence, how might it compare this time to the last impeachment hearings, which were in 1999?
Well, that impeachment trial in 1999 for President Bill Clinton is worlds away from what we're going here today. So, and that really speaks to the way the political atmosphere has changed in those two decades since the last impeachment trial here in the United States. Democrats and Republicans during Clinton's impeachment trial actually sat down and hammered out the rules together. They sat in a room and they said, look, this is going to be a contentious process, but we want to agree on the ground rules, the rules of the game. That definitely did not happen here in this case with the impeachment of President Trump.
Now, if the rules are not to the Democrats' liking, is there anything that Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer can do if he wants to vote to change or amend the process once it gets going?
Well, he can certainly try, and that's something that he was saying earlier this morning here on Capitol Hill. He plans to offer amendments to this resolution that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is introducing, laying out those ground rules and procedures. Basically, think of an amendment as an argument, and they could spend up to 2 hours of debate on every amendment that Chuck Schumer introduces. So there's going to be a big back and forth, but ultimately, because it's a Republican majority in the U.S. Senate, Chuck Schumer will have to sway a couple of Republican senators onto his side in order to get those to pass.
We have about a minute and a half left. It appears, as you've said, that the hearing could go late into the night. What impact could that have? Will people be staying up all night watching these proceedings?
I think that's a really interesting question, because remember that we're also going through a presidential election here in the United States. So in terms of the news that the average American sees every day, we're saturated with political coverage here in the United States. We're already hearing from multiple Democratic presidential candidates. We already hear from President Trump all the time. There's a real question about whether the average American, who of course has a job, has a family, has a busy life of their own, is going to be really engaged in the minute-by-minute process of the impeachment. I think that people are engaged in it, but staying up late into the night, I sincerely doubt that.
Got it. Thank you so much for coming on our show.
You're so welcome.
That was VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson.
And while members of the U.S. Congress focus on the impeachment trial in Washington, President Trump is attending the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. In his speech in Davos Tuesday, The president called for more foreign investment in the United States. But he also took time to comment about the impeachment. Saga Megani with the Associated Press has more.
At the World Economic Forum in Switzerland, the president's facing a balancing act, tempering his anger over impeachment while looking to project global leadership. He used his speech in Davos to laud the economy.
America's economic turnaround has been nothing short of spectacular.
The audience of business and political leaders responded with virtual silence. The president did not mention impeachment, but later repeated a familiar refrain to reporters.
That whole thing is a total hoax. So I'm sure it's going to work out fine.
His spokeswoman says the president has a full schedule in Davos, but will be briefed on the Senate proceedings. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
The annual World Economic Forum is a chance for world leaders in government, in business, academia, and global development to discuss the world's problems. And some criticism, however, say that the forum is a club of world elites who are very much the cause of some of the global issues that they will discuss. Gail Smith is the president of the and the CEO of the One Campaign and the former administrator of the United States Agency for International Development. I spoke with her earlier, and she says that if the leaders are to address some of the issues such as wealth inequality, they will need new approaches.
I think obviously climate is one, and it's one I think that will get some attention. But I think the other issue that's looming large and getting bigger and more potent every day is growing economic inequality. And I think it's a global issue that really needs serious attention.
Davos has been criticized for being a club of, you know, world elites who are
right.
In many cases responsible for some of these issues that they will be discussing, from climate change, carbon emissions, to some of, you know, the global conflicts that we see taking root in places like the Middle East and other places. President Trump just used his opening remarks, for example, to go after climate change activists, calling them, prophets of doom. Now, do you see a scenario where these leaders are realistically going to address some of these issues?
Well, I think what tends to happen at Davos is that there's sometimes agreement on specific issues and an initiative is taken. That's different than real systemic change. And I think what's unfortunate is that those who gather in Davos tend to be some of the most influential, powerful people in the world. They've got the ability to make some really big decisions that could change the lives for the better of billions of people. It tends to be a little bit more project-oriented, if you will. Let's have a partnership or an agreement to do something over a fixed time period. Now, not all of those are bad. Gavi, the Global Alliance for Vaccines, was launched out of Davos some years ago, and it has since saved 13 million lives. That's an important piece. But in terms of the big picture, in terms of thinking about how the world works and what's needed in terms of collaboration, in terms of what the responsibility is of the most powerful players on the planet, I think there's a tendency sometimes to dance around the edges of those discussions.
And what is the status of Gavi as we speak right now, and what do you hope that they do about it?
Well, I think they've got an opportunity. Gavi is just now mounting its replenishment for the period 2021 to 2025. So they're doing the equivalent of a funding round. They're aiming to raise $7.4 billion, which translates into the lives of another 8 million people and vaccinating 300 million kids. So the people gathered in Davos today and tomorrow and over the coming days could put their heads and their resources together and pledge to get that replenishment done, whether private sector, government. It's not a hard move for the kind of capital that's on the mountain there in Davos. So we'd really like to see that happen. But we'd like to see that happen as part and parcel of a bigger conversation. What do we do about the fact that the gap between those who have the resources to get to Davos and be at the table and those who don't is growing ever wider?
Right. And we did see that Oxfam report that came out yesterday. And one of the things that you write about is you say that despite all the progress that we've seen in the past couple of years, that the scale and the complexity of the challenges that we face in the world currently that we cannot simply rely on the same old solutions. What are some of the new solutions, in your view, that would address some of these old challenges?
Well, I think, you know, if you look at the rules that govern how the world works that were written after World War II, a lot of those need updating. And whether it's things from who's got the power on the global institutions through which we cooperate, that tends to be uneven. That can be reconciled. Whether it is how we think about the global economy. I mean, again, one of the things I will be interested in seeing is whether in discussing the global economy in Davos, they talk about the continental free trade area that's been agreed in Africa. Africa is a big player in the global economy. It tends not to be as included in the discussions as some other parts of the world. So how do you really change the dynamics that you're talking about? Global means global. It's not just the wealthy.
That was Gail Smith, the chief executive officer of the One Campaign. It's a global organization fighting poverty. I spoke to her earlier in Washington, D.C. VOA's international edition continues. North Korea said on Tuesday that since the United States had ignored its deadline for nuclear talks, that it no longer is bound by its commitments to halt nuclear and long-range missile tests. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un had set a year-end deadline for denuclearization talks with the United States, and White House officials said at the time that the United States had opened channels of communication. However, talks remain stalled, and Pyongyang says Washington has not offered enough concessions. The North Korean announcement at the United Nations in Geneva comes as Pyongyang apparently has appointed a new foreign minister, Lee Sung-won. In another sign, the country might be realigning its foreign policy. VOA Seoul correspondent William Gallo has been covering the story. He spoke earlier today with International Edition's editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, about the diplomatic developments.
Yeah, so this is a former senior military official in North Korea's army. He is known for having sort of a blunt-speaking demeanor. He led several North Korean delegations and inter-Korean talks, and at those talks, he was sort of known as a guy who would make sort of insensitive, straightforward type jokes, and none of the jokes I actually read in the Korean media made any sense in English, but suffice it to say that they were considered controversial to South Korean media. He just speaks his mind. He has quite a reputation for being blunt talking.
So what does this change in the foreign ministry mean in both North Korea's relationship with South Korea and with the U.S.?
Well, on the one hand, North Korea has given every sign that it is sort of tired, is done with diplomacy with the United States, especially regarding nuclear talks. So this could be the latest evidence that North Korea intends to take a hardline approach. However, a lot of analysts that I've talked to today have cautioned that, look, it's not as if his personality, this new foreign minister's personality, is going to play a big part in what he does in North Korean foreign policy, which is totally dictated by Kim Jong-un. The foreign ministry is not actually that powerful when it comes to forming policy. It does play a role in implementing and sort of trying to carry out whatever Kim Jong-un decides. But, you know, regardless of whether this guy tends to be brash or brute or whatever the adjective may be, he'll probably do what Kim Jong-un says.
Now, this new change at the foreign ministry in North Korea comes at a time when the South Korean relationship with the U.S. government, its chief ally, is a bit strained. What's going on there?
Well, the biggest issue is the cost-sharing debate. The United States and South Korea failed to reach an agreement on how to split the cost of the 28,500 troops that are in South Korea. This is the second straight year that happened. The deadline was actually the end of the year, so we are now a few weeks past due on that. It is expected they will eventually reach a deal, but this has caused quite a strain on the relationship. And the U.S. Ambassador Harry Harris, a former Navy admiral, has sort of taken the role here in Seoul of playing the bad guy in a lot of ways. He talks to media and will, you know, consistently push the U.S. demand that South Korea increase the amount that it pays for the U.S. troops. and he's been villainized quite a bit for that.
That was VOA's William Gallo in Seoul speaking with Kate Pound Dawson. This is VOA's International Edition.
What are the root causes of conflict in Libya? Why does the leader of the internationally recognized Government of National Accord, Fayez al-Sarraj, face a challenge from General Khalifa Haftar, who has the backing of Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Egypt? Host Carol Castiel and VOA Middle East reporter Mohammed Al-Shinawi talk with Libya observer Jason Pack of the Middle East Institute. Listen this Saturday and Sunday on Press Conference USA. Brian Katulis, Senior Fellow for National Security and Counterterrorism at the Center for American Progress, and Kaylee Thomas, Research Associate at the Center for New American Security, discuss the political and strategic fallout from the U.S. targeted killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. Listen this Saturday and Sunday on Encounter on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. A panel appointed by Myanmar's government to investigate alleged abuses against the Rohingya community absolved the military of genocide. In a report, the panel members, two foreign ambassadors and two Myanmar nationals, also said the military did not commit any rapes in its 2017 crackdown in northern Rakhine State. But the panel did say that soldiers killed hundreds of civilians in what could amount to war crimes. Rights groups and Rohingya exiles have dismissed the report, saying there was genocide, which included widespread rape and the deaths of thousands of civilians. The release of the panel's report comes days before the International Court of Justice is expected to rule on a request for emergency measures in a genocide case brought by the Gambia against the Yangon government. For reaction to the panel's report, I spoke earlier today to Rohingya rights activist Nay San Lin in Frankfurt, Germany.
They said, you know, about 500 to 600 people were killed. Even the UN fact-finding mission has mentioned at least 10,000 people were killed. And they said there were no rapes. This is completely lie, you know. There are a few, many hundred women were raped. I myself went to the camp a few times since late 2017. I met with the many rape victims. You know, I have the picture with them and I have their testimony. I have the medical examination paper copy with me. So these are the completely lies. The main thing is they just want to say, you know, that this is not the genocide, but these two ambassadors and their member are not the genocide scholar to decide, you know, whether this is the genocide or not. With this 15-page report, I can see clearly that they are just advocating this Burmese military and the government. Their so-called independent commission of inquiry have been saying the same thing, that the military, the security force, have committed some, you know, the war crime or the serious human rights violation, but these are not constituted to the genocide, or they don't have the genocidal intent.
So you're saying it is basically just repeating things that the military itself has already said. What is your view on how capable and willing the government of Myanmar is, or the justice system in Myanmar is, to try the perpetrators of these crimes?
This justice mechanism inside is completely incapable. Whoever committed this crime, they want to try inside the country. But whatever they have committed, whether this is, you know, the genocide or the crime against humanity, these are the against the international law. So what we are seeking is we want the justice through the international justice mechanism. They are protecting the main perpetrator. What they are claiming is the soldier from the ground level, they have committed this crime, but yes, they have killed the people, but they have killed these people. They have raped the women. They have destroyed all the structures according to the order of the commander-in-chief and the other generals. Whatever they are saying is they are protecting the main perpetrator. We want to try this main perpetrator at the International Criminal Court.
Thursday is we will hear a ruling from the International Court of Justice. What do you expect to hear on Thursday, and what will the implications of that be?
Tomorrow I'm going to travel to The Hague to attend this hearing on Thursday. So we are expecting that the court will issue the provisional measure to prevent the further crime against the Rohingya inside the country, and not to destroy the evidence, because you know they have already bulldozed about 20 to 30 village. They have been destroying the evidence in the country. So we are very much expecting that the court will issue that this provisional measure on Thursday.
That was Rohingya rights activist Nason Lin speaking from Frankfurt, Germany.
The World Health Organization says that the new coronavirus is likely to spread in China and other countries, and is arguing governments to implement preventive infection control measures in health facilities. The WHO confirms that 278 cases of the disease, including 6 deaths. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization calls the coronavirus a fast-moving disease and says the number of cases and deaths is changing quickly. The agency is stepping up measures to get to the source of the infection as quickly as possible and to provide the public with information it needs to protect itself. The WHO will be convening an emergency committee meeting Wednesday to see whether the virus constitutes a public health emergency of international concern. A team of experts is in the city of Wuhan, China, where the outbreak occurred. The experts are working with local health officials to investigate the source of the disease. WHO spokesman Tarek Shazarevich says not much is known about the new coronavirus. He says how the disease is transmitted, its severity, the extent to which it has spread, or its source are unclear.
Based on current information, an animal source seems the most likely primary source of this outbreak, with limited human-to-human transmission occurring between close contacts. Based on previous experience with respiratory illnesses, and in particular with other coronavirus outbreaks, and our analysis of data shared by China, human-to-human transmission is occurring.
Jazarevich says human-to-human transmission appears to be limited, and it occurs between people who are in close contact with each other. He says the coronavirus infection can cause mild to severe symptoms and can be fatal, but reports of some new cases, he says, have tended to be mild. The coronavirus was discovered at the end of last year in a fish market in Wuhan. The World Health Organization says it is spreading widely, and more cases should be expected in other parts of China and possibly in other countries in the coming days. Fears are growing that the mysterious virus could sicken a great many people during the upcoming lunar holiday, a time when millions of people in China travel within the country and abroad to be with their families. A number of airports around the world are screening travelers for the infection. The World Health Organization says that is one of the measures countries can use to identify possible carriers of the disease. However, it says the current known risks do not justify restrictions on travel or trade. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Hundreds of Central American migrants are stranded on the river border between Guatemala and Mexico, with Mexican National Guard troops deployed to keep them from moving into the country and north toward the United States. On Monday, Mexican security forces fired tear gas at the rock-hurling migrants who waded into a river trying to enter into Mexico. Mexican President Andre Manuel López Obrador told a news conference on Tuesday that operations to control the flow of migrants at the country's southern border were meant to protect them.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. We want to thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Nadia Taha. Our engineer has been Nashwan Kali. I'm Jackson Vunganyi, together with Jason Putinkin. Enjoy the rest of your day, everyone.